There were other vessels in the roadstead, mostly big dhow-rigged bugaloos typical of the Arab coastal traders. But there was another fully rigged ship at anchor half a mile further downstream, flying the flag of Brazil at her peak. Even as Robin paused to watch her, there came the clank of her capstan, and men ran up the ratlines and spread out along her yards. She was getting under way. Then Robin realized that there was unusual activity all about her. Small boats were plying from the shore to the anchored dhows, and even on Huron's deck there was a huddle of men on the quarterdeck. Robin turned towards them and realized that the tallest of them was Mungo St. John. His arm was in a sling, and he looked drawn and pale, but his expression was forbidding, the dark, curved brows drawn together in a frown, and the mouth a thin, cruel line, as he listened attentively to one of his seamen. So absorbed was he that he did not notice Robin until she was only a few paces away. Then he swung towards her, and all the questions and demands stayed behind her lips, for his voice was harsh. "Your coming was an act of God, Dr. Ballantyne," he said.
"Why do you say that?"
"There is a plague in the Barracoons," he said. "Most of the other buyers are cutting their losses and leaving." He glanced downstream to where the Brazilian schooner had set reefed main and jib, and was running down towards the bar and the open sea, and there was activity aboard most of the other vessels. "But I have over 1,000 prime blacks a-fattening ashore, and I'll be damned if I'll run now, at least not until I know what it is." Robin stared at him. Her mind was a whirl of doubts and fears. Plague was a layman's word. It covered everything from the Black Death to syphilis, the Grand Pox, as it was called. "I'll go ashore immediately," she said, and Mungo St. John nodded. "I thought you would say that," he said. "I will go with you." "No," her tone brooked no argument. "You will aggravate that wound, and in your weakened condition you will be easy prey to this plague, whatever it is." She glanced at Tipu, and his face split laterally into that broad, toad-like grin, and he stepped up beside her. "By God, ma'am, I've had them all," said Nathaniel, the little pockmarked bosun, "and none of them killed me yet." And he stepped up to her other hand. Robin sat in the stern while Tipu and Nathaniel handled the oars, and as they pulled across the ebb towards the shore, the bosun explained what they would find there. "Each of the traders has his own barracoon built and guarded by his own men," he told Robin. "He buys from the portos at the Blackbirds when they're brought in." As Robin listened to Nathaniel, she realized the answers to questions that had worried her and Zuga. This was the reason why Pereira had tried so desperately to persuade them not to bring the expedition south of the Zambezi River, and why, when all else had failed, he had attacked it with his armed brigands and tried to destroy it. He had been protecting his brother's trade routes and selling area. It was not mere avarice and lust, but a logical attempt to preserve this lucrative enterprise from discovery. She went on listening to Nathaniel. "Each trader fattens his wares ashore, like pigs for the market. That way they are stronger for the crossing, and he makes sure that they are healthy and not going to bring sickness aboard with them. There are 23 barracoons here, some small ones with 20 blacks or so belonging to the small traders, right on up to the big ones like Hurons, with 1,000 and more prime blackbirds in the cage. We have the slave decks set up in Huron's hold, and we would have begun taking them aboard any day, but now..." Nathaniel shrugged and spat on the horny, calloused palms of each hand in turn, and then plied himself to the oars once more. "Are you a Christian, Nathaniel?" Robin asked softly.
"That I am, ma'am," he said proudly. "As good a Christian as ever sailed out of Martha's Vineyard." "Do you think God approves of what you are doing here to these poor people?"
"Hewers of wood, ma'am, and drawers of water, like the Bible says," the weather-beaten sailor told her, so glibly that she knew that the reply had been put in his mouth, and she guessed by whom. Once they were ashore, Tipu led the small party with Robin in the centre and Nathaniel carrying her chest in the rear. Captain Mungo St. John had chosen the best site available for his barracoon, on a rise of ground at a distance from the river. The sheds were well built, with floors of sawn timber raised above the mud, and good roofs thatched with palmetto leaves. Huron's guards had not deserted.
proof of the discipline which Mungo St. John maintained, and the slaves in the barracks had evidently been carefully chosen. They were all well set up men and women, and the copper cookers were filled with boiling farina, so that their bellies bulged and their skins were glossy. At Robin's direction, they were lined up, and she passed swiftly down the ranks. There were some mild ailments which she singled out for later treatment, but she found none of the symptoms which she so dreaded. "There is no plague here," she decided. "Not yet." "Come," said Tipu. He led her through the palm groves, and the next barracoon had been deserted by the traders who had built it and stocked it. Already the slaves were hungry and confused by their sudden liberation. "You are free to go," Robin told them. "Go back to your own land." She was not certain that they understood her. They squatted in the mud and stared at her blankly. It was as though they had lost all power of independent thought or action, and she knew that they would never be able to make their way back along the hyena road, even if they survived the coming epidemic. With a flash of horror, Robin realized that without their slave masters, these poor creatures were doomed to a lingering death by starvation and disease. Their masters had cleared out the storerooms before they left. There was not a cupful of farina or cornmeal left in any of the barracoons they visited that morning. "We will have to feed them," Robin said.
"We have food for our own. That is all," Tipu told her impassively.
"He's right, ma'am," Nathaniel confirmed. "We feed them, then we'll starve our own blackbirds. Besides, most of them are poor goods, not worth the price of a cup of farina." In the second barracoon, Robin thought that she had at last discovered the first plague victims, for the low thatched sheds were crammed with rows of prostrate naked figures, and their low moanings and whimperings was a heartbreaking sound, while the smell of corruption was thick and oily on the palate. It was Tipu who corrected her.
"China birds," he grunted,
and for a moment Robin did not understand, and she stooped over the nearest body, then straightened immediately. Despite her training, cold blisters of sweat formed on her forehead. By imperial decree from Peking, no black African slave could be landed on the shores of China unless he had been rendered incapable of reproducing his own kind. The emperor was concerned that future generations would not be plagued by the growth of an alien population in their midst. The traders found it expedient to castrate their purchases in the barracoons so that losses caused by the operation could be absorbed before the expense of the long voyage was incurred. It was crudely done. A tourniquet applied to the root of the scrotum, and then the entire scrotal sac removed at a single knife stroke, and the wound cauterized immediately with a heated iron or a daub of hot pitch. About 60% would survive the shock and subsequent mortification, but their price per capita was so enhanced that the trader could face 40% losses with equanimity. There was nothing that Robin could do for so many. She felt overwhelmed by the suffering and misery all around her, and she stumbled out onto the muddy pathway blinded by her own tears. In the next barracoon, the one nearest to the central auction block, she found the first plague victims. Once again the sheds had been deserted by the slave masters, and the dimly lit thatched sheds were filled with naked figures, some squatting motionlessly, others lying on the damp earthen floor, knees drawn up, shaking with the cold of fever, and powerless to lift themselves out of their own bodily wastes. The sound of delirium and suffering was murderous, like that of insects in an English orchard on a hot summer's day. The first sufferer that Robin touched was a young girl, just beyond puberty, and her skin was burning hot. She rolled her head from side to side, endlessly and senselessly, mouthing snatches of gibberish. Swiftly, Robin ran her fingertips down the girl's naked, bulging stomach, and immediately she felt the tiny lumps under the hot skin, like pellets of buckshot. There could be no doubt. "Smallpox," she said simply, and Tipu drew back fearfully. "Wait outside," she told him, and he went swiftly and with obvious relief. She turned to Nathaniel. She had noticed the little pitted scars in his folded, sun-toughened skin, and now there was no fear in his expression. "When?" she asked. when I was a boy, he said. It killed my old ma and my brothers.
We have work to do, she told him.
In the gloomy, stinking shed, the dead were piled with the living. And on some of the racked and furnace-heated black bodies, the plague had already burst into full flower. They found it in all its stages. Papules beneath the skin had erupted into vesicles. Bubbles of clear, thin fluid that thickened into pustules, which in turn burst and released a custard-thick trickle of matter. These will live, Robin told Nathaniel. The plague is purging from their blood. She found a man whose open pox had already crusted over. While Nathaniel held the man from moving, Robin scraped away the crusty scabs with a spatula and gathered them in a wide-mouthed glass bottle that had once held quinine powder.
This strain of the disease has been attenuated, Robin explained impatiently, and for the first time she saw fear in the flecked eyes of Mungo St. John.
The Turks first used this method 200 years ago.
I would prefer to sail away from it, Mungo St. John said quietly, staring at the stoppered bottle, which was half filled with damp yellow matter, in which were small flecks of blood.
It would be no use. The infection is already aboard. Robin shook her head firmly. In a week or less, Huron would be turned into a stinking plague ship filled with dying men.
Mungo turned away from her and went to the ship's rail.
He stood there with one hand clasped into a fist behind his back, the other still in its sling, staring at the shore, where the thatched roofs of the barracoons just showed above the mangroves.
"You cannot leave those poor wretches," Robin said. "They will starve. I alone could never find food to feed that multitude. You are responsible for them."
He did not answer her for a moment. Then he turned back to study her curiously.
"If Huron sailed with her holds empty, would you stay here on this fever and smallpox-ridden coast to tend this multitude of doomed savages?" he asked.
"Of course."
She was still impatient, and he inclined his head. His eyes no longer mocked, but were sober, perhaps even filled with respect.
"If you will not stay for common humanity, then stay for self-interest," she scorned him with her tone. $1,000,000 worth of human cattle, and I will save them for you."
"You would save them to be sold into captivity," he insisted.
"Even slavery is better than death," she replied.
Again he turned away from her, taking a slow turn of the quarter-deck, frowning thoughtfully, puffing on the long black cheroot so that wreaths of tobacco smoke drifted behind him. And Robin and half Huron's crew watched him, some fearfully, others with resignation.
"You say that you have yourself undergone this thing?"
His eyes were drawn back, with loathing fascination, to the little bottle that stood in the centre of his chart table.
For answer, Robin lifted the sleeve of her shirt and showed him the distinctive, deeply pocked scar on her forearm.
A minute longer he hesitated, and she went on persuasively.
"I will give you a strain of the disease that is passant, that has been weakened and attenuated by passage through another man's body, rather than the virulent form of the plague which you will breathe on the very air and which will kill most of you."
"There is no risk,"
she hesitated and then replied firmly. "There is always risk, but 100, nay 1,000 times less risk than if you take the disease from the air."
With an abrupt gesture, Mungo St. John ripped open the sleeve on his left arm with his teeth and offered it to her.
"Do it," he said, "but in God's name do it quickly before my courage fails."
She drew the point of her scalpel across the smooth, deeply tanned skin of his forearm, and the tiny crimson droplets rose behind it. He did not flinch, but when she dipped the scalpel into the bottle and scraped up a speck of the noisome yellow stuff, he blanched and made as if to jerk his arm away, then with an obvious effort controlled himself. She smeared the pus over the tiny wound, and he stepped back and turned from her.
"All of you!"
His voice was rough, with his horror and disgust. "Every last one of you," he told the gaping, terrified seaman.